Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Robert Jareski, coordinator of Code Pink's World Court Campaign, who assesses the worrying lack of specificity in the 20-point Gaza ceasefire plan, which could lead to a resumption of Israel's war. Marine veteran Bryce Lockwood, who recounts Israel's 1967 attack on the USS Liberty during the Six-Day War and its lasting impact on Israeli-U.S. relations. And Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive-turned whistleblower, who links the current federal government shutdown to America's long-failing healthcare system. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Brazil's former right-wing president, Jair Bolsonaro, was convicted in mid-September for plotting a coup against current center-left president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Bolsonaro was sentenced to 27 years in prison by the Federal Supreme Court and barred from running for public office again until 2060. Bolsonaro will likely appeal his conviction, but his hope for securing amnesty for a pardon have fallen flat. The former president's best option for receiving a future pardon is from Sao Paulo Governor Tarcísio de Freitas, but he recently announced he won't be running for president next October. After Bolsonaro's conviction, his son Eduardo moved to Texas to lobby the White House on his father's behalf. But since Trump imposed a 50% tariff on Brazil in July, other threatened sanctions haven't materialized. At the same time, Trump is getting stiff opposition to U.S. tariffs from big beef producers like JBS, a Brazilian meat processing giant, whose U.S. subsidiary donated to Trump's 2024 campaign. The Associated Press reports Russia and Vietnam developed a backdoor mechanism to elude U.S. and Western sanctions targeting Russia. Profits from a joint Russia-Vietnam oil and gas enterprise in Siberia are being used to pay off military contracts, avoiding open transfers of cash through the global banking system. Under the arrangement, Vietnam has purchased Russian military equipment, including fighter jets, tanks, and warships on credit from Moscow, then paid that credit back from its share of profits made in the joint Vietnam-Russia oil company. The goal of the agreement is to keep cash quietly flowing, even if sanctions aimed at ending Russia's war on Ukraine are strengthened. The revelation comes as the U.S. is working to strengthen ties with Vietnam as an ally to counter China's growing influence and aggressive actions in Southeast Asia. At the same time, the president's family business, the Trump Organization, also broke ground earlier this year on a $1.5 billion luxury golf complex near the capital, Hanoi. Although the president's sons run the organization, financial records released in June indicate that Trump himself benefits personally from the business. In 2017, Hurricane Maria ravaged Puerto Rico with 155-mile-per-hour winds. The island's rural mountainous regions were hardest hit, with residents losing power and cell phone access. After housing in some communities were almost entirely wiped out, people were forced to build their own makeshift shelters. In much of rural Puerto Rico, it took a year to restore power, the longest power outage in U.S. history. Hurricane Maria exposed huge gaps in food security, where over 40% of the island's residents live below the poverty line, and food insecurity is four times the rate as in the mainland U.S. The Grist reports that in the hurricane's aftermath, community leaders started to rethink emergency preparedness. Food co-ops, community gardens, and school-based agricultural programs emerged to fill the gaps left by the government. Mutual aid kitchens and community-led supermarkets have also expanded their work. These projects aren't just temporary disaster responses. DeGrist observes that these are models of long-term resilience and food independence for Puerto Rico and elsewhere. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The first crucial phase of the U.S.-brokered 20-point Gaza ceasefire agreement was implemented on October 13th, when Hamas released 20 living Israeli hostages who've been held in Gaza since the October 7th attack on Israel that killed 1,200, and Israel released some 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees, many of whom had never been charged with a crime. As the ceasefire took effect, critical food supplies and humanitarian aid have begun to be transported into the Gaza Strip, where 2.3 million people face widespread starvation and malnutrition. While humanitarian aid groups say they want to vastly increase the flow of aid into Gaza, Israeli authorities said they'll restrict the number of trucks allowed to enter the territory due to the limited number of deceased hostage bodies released by Hamas thus far. Israel's brutal two-year assault on Gaza that's left more than 67,000 mostly Palestinian civilians dead has been condemned by the United Nations and human rights groups as a genocide. After the completion of the first phase of the ceasefire agreement, the fundamental questions of who will govern Gaza, when will Israeli forces fully withdraw, and how reconstruction can begin have been deferred to an uncertain second phase that lacks enforcement mechanisms, clear timelines, or international guarantees. Your reporter spoke with Robert Jureski, a lawyer and activist who serves as coordinator of Code Pink's World Court campaign. Here he assesses the worrying lack of specificity in the 20-point Gaza ceasefire plan, which could lead to a resumption of the war.
We see Palestinians and people around the world are relieved that there are no more bombs dropping. There were some shortly after Israel agreed to the ceasefire. They continued to deploy ordinances against Palestinians. There's a desperate need for, more than just food. It's medicine. It's like they need shelter and, Israel is the occupying power. It has an obligation to protect civilians under its control. But the concerns are exactly what you mentioned, Scott. I mean, there's the details are very slim. The enforcement mechanism is secretive. It's not really known. There was an announcement that Trump and or the U.S. And Qatar, Egypt, and Turkey had signed an agreement. And there's some suspicion that they are the enforcers, Turkey, Qatar, and Egypt, with encouraging Hamas to go along with this amorphous plan and sort of guaranteeing it to them, and the U.S. doing the same with Israel. It's really a misnomer to call this a peace plan. I mean, this is, you can't have peace without justice, and there is no justice in this plan. It's incredibly one-sided, and it's really a neocolonial plan for domination of not just Gaza, but also of the region. Because really, what happens when Israel is not held to account for what we all saw it do in Gaza, right, for 2 years, for the first months, and when South Africa filed their application at the World Court in December of 2023 and then received provisional measures from the World Court to order Israel to take certain measures because they were plausibly violating the rights that were guaranteed under the Genocide Convention belonging to the Palestinians. It was a plausible genocide. We saw Israel ignore those orders. They ignored those orders, the ones issued in March and the ones issued in May. And these have the force of international law, but Israel ignored them. we've seen so many serial violations of fundamental precepts, killing negotiators, sovereignty of nations, collective punishment against the Palestinians. We've seen the snipering of children, targeting of hospitals, even the digging up of graves in Gaza, that this plan, which has no accountability measures in it, is really an attempt to distract all of us from what we've all seen and what we've all been demanding, which is an end to Israeli impunity. And it does nothing but reward Israel, rewarding it by allowing it to continue to occupy territory in Gaza and impose conditions before it will follow the world court's direction, which is to dismantle the settlement project, the occupation of Palestinian territories, which includes Gaza. There are no settlements there, but it is an occupying power over Gaza. That settlement project and those practices are illegal. The World Court, July 19th, 2024, declared them illegal, and they had to be dismantled as soon as practicable. And the UN General Assembly in September of 2024 gave Israel a year. That year was up September 18th.
During the course of this horrible two-year war, just in recent months, we've had several important European nations recognize a Palestinian state. Are you optimistic that that project of recognition of a Palestinian state that grew out of this horrible war can move forward in any positive direction?
All too often, there have been conditions that are imposed on the Palestinian state that European countries wish to establish, which involves, reforms and disarmament and de-radicalization, which is also in the Trump plan. It just shows the unfairness of the vision of the West and the hypocrisy of the rules-based order in the West, because the entity that has been imposing, that has been committing a genocide for the last 2 years, has no conditions imposed on it for continued relations with the West, while the victims of Israel have all sorts of conditions before they are to be allowed to enjoy their fundamental rights by the West. This last 2 years has really unmasked the phantasm of liberal Zionism and also the phantasm of a Western liberal rules-based order.
That was Robert Jareski, a lawyer and activist who serves as coordinator of Code Pink's World Court campaign. Find more news and analysis on the Gaza ceasefire agreement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Bryce Lockwood is an 85-year-old retired U.S. Marine who was aboard the American intelligence gathering ship the USS Liberty when it was bombed by Israel in the Mediterranean on June 8, 1967. The attack occurred 3 days after the start of the Six-Day War between Israel and its Arab neighbors. Lockwood, who lives in Missouri, recently traveled to Connecticut to speak at an event featuring a representation of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., known as The Wall. He also spoke at a Connecticut mosque. Lockwood was one of three Marine Corps linguists aboard the ship and was seriously burned when a torpedo exploded. He was awarded a Purple Heart and also a Silver Star for rescuing three sailors trapped in flooded ship compartments. Altogether, 34 were killed and 174 wounded. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Lockwood about the cover-up of the incident by the U.S. government and his belief that this incident has led to Israel's actions steeped in impunity in the decades since.
I was aboard the USS Liberty in 1967 during the 6 days war between Israel and the United Arab Republic, which at that time included primarily Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and to a lesser extent, Libya. War was apparently imminent between Israel and their neighbors. Israel actually attacked their neighbors. We aboard the ship had an intercept copy of a message ordering the attack on Egyptian forces on the 5th of June, 1967. The USS Liberty was in international waters approximately 13 and a half miles off the Sinai Peninsula when we were brutally attacked approximately 1400 hours, 2 o'clock local time, by Israeli unmarked aircraft, a violation of international law. Our distress frequencies were jammed by the Israelis. That's a violation of international law. Our life rafts were napalm. What life rafts, the lifeboats we had, were all napalm, destroyed. We had three inflatable life rafts left. Israeli motor torpedo boats machine gunned those life rafts, took one of them away with them. We were fired upon by the Israelis for the better share of 2 hours, aircraft, motor torpedo boats, 826 large caliber strikes aboard the ship. There were over 3,100 heavy machine gun caliber strikes on the ship. Five torpedoes were fired at us. One struck the ship just forward of amidships. I was in an enclosed area below the waterline where that torpedo struck. I was less than 10 feet from it, looking at it when it blew. It killed 25 men all around me. 34 Americans were killed. 174 were wounded. Actually, there were probably more than that, but there were a total of 208 Purple Hearts awarded. Israel claimed it was a case of mistaken identity. They claimed they had mistaken us for an Egyptian ship, the El Kasir, which was a World War I horse transport. I suppose you could claim Israeli pilots were colorblind. U.S. ships are painted gray with hallmarkings in English lettering. Egyptian ships are painted black with hallmarkings in Arabic script. Hardly possible to mistake the identity. The American flag was flying. There was a short 5-day inquiry made by the U.S. government in Rota, Spain, that concluded we accepted Israel's excuse of mistaken identity and case was closed. The crew members were ordered not to talk about it under a threat of imprisonment, and the whole case was covered up. It has never been investigated by the U.S. Congress, as is required by Article 1, Section 8, U.S. Constitution.
Why didn't the administration at the time consider this a problem and want to investigate?
We think there's considerable evidence that the attack was planned by our own government. The number two man in the U.S. CIA at the time, a man by the name of James Eagleton, was also an Israeli Mossad agent. We think we were set up under a pretext of sink the ship, everyone aboard it killed, no witnesses, blame it on the Egyptians, get the U.S. involved in war on the side of Israel.
Bryce Lockwood, you said that President Johnson quashed any investigation because he said he didn't want to embarrass an ally, meaning Israel.
We did not know who was attacking us. How did President Johnson know we were under attack by his allies? A very good question. There have been numerous letters to congressmen, senators, State Department officials, all of them have said pretty much, we accepted Israel's claim of mistaken identity and case was closed.
What's the import of this incident?
Israel realized as a result of our Congress doing nothing that they could do anything they wanted and the U.S. government would do nothing. As a result of this incident in 1967, Israel has run roughshod over her neighbors, made numerous attacks, Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, just recently in Qatar, and we've done nothing. Look what's happened to Gaza. They are completely destroying the Palestinian people in both Gaza and West Bank, and we have done nothing.
That was Bryce Lockwood, who was aboard the USS Liberty when it was bombed by Israel in 1967. Learn more about Lockwood's story and the history of this incident by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the federal shutdown entered a third week, President Trump and his Office of Management and Budget Director Russell Vogt announced the firing of 4,000 government workers, but warned there were many more terminations to come. Trump, who says he's now targeting workers in what he labeled Democratic agencies, had already laid off some 300,000 federal workers through billionaire Elon Musk's DOGE program earlier this year. Trump has said that after the shutdown ends, he may block back pay owed to hundreds of thousands of workers, violating legislation he signed into law in 2019. The impact of the government shutdown is immediately being felt by 750,000 federal employees who've been furloughed or are being forced to work without pay. About 1.3 million active-duty military personnel are also on track to miss their paychecks unless Congress votes to allocate those funds. The SNAP Food and Nutrition Program and the Healthy Food Program for Women, Infants, and Children, or WIC, could run out of funds within days. Since October 1st, Senate Democrats have refused to vote for legislation to reopen the government unless it includes a commitment to extend expiring Affordable Care Act health insurance subsidies, which, if not restored, will increase monthly premiums for more than 22 million ACA enrollees by 75% to 114%. It's estimated that if rates rise, some 2 to 4 million Americans will lose their health insurance altogether. Your reporter spoke with Wendell Potter, a former health insurance industry executive turned whistleblower who links the current federal government shutdown to America's long-failing healthcare system.
As awful as a shutdown is for so many people, certainly that includes federal workers, but a lot of people who depend on federal government to be operating as it should. That aside, this focuses a lot of attention on health care and health insurance once again in ways that we haven't seen in a long time. The thing that is keeping the two parties apart is over subsidies to make health insurance affordable for millions of Americans. It's important to note that increasingly premiums have been going up every single year. Right now, a family policy cost on average, if you get it through an employer, more than $25,000 a year. The policies in the ACA marketplaces, which is what we're talking about here, the Obamacare plans, have similar price tags, and people just simply cannot afford health insurance in that marketplace unless there is federal support. And during the pandemic, there were some additional subsidies that were put in place that make it possible for more people to get some help, financial help, covering their premiums. They are set to expire at the end of this year, and the Democrats are saying that they will not support this bill to reopen the government, the spending bill, unless there is a deal to extend those subsidies. Republicans have kind of dug in, saying, no, we're not going to, that's not on the, on the table, we're not going to talk about that now. It leaves millions of people in a quandary. It even leaves insurance companies wondering what to do, because they have to determine how much they're going to charge next year, and people will start having to enroll or make decisions on November the 1st. So time is running out here. Pretty soon, people are going to be getting notices from their insurance companies if they get coverage in the ACA marketplaces. Big, big, big increases in their premiums.
Wendell, I did want to ask you about Trump and the Republican Party's big, cruel, and obscene federal budget bill, not the big, beautiful bill, as they call it. That bill was passed by Congress on July 4th, and it cut over $1 trillion in federal health care spending, which the Congressional Budget Office, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, says will cause 10 to 17 million Americans to lose their health care insurance. In your view, what's the long-term impact of these very deep cuts? I think by historical standards, it's the largest cuts to health care in U.S. history. And the impact, of course, on our already failing U.S. health care system that leaves out so many millions of Americans.
Yeah. And we've seen the headlines, or most of us have seen the news reports, that many millions of Americans who currently get Medicaid benefits will lose those benefits because of these cuts in future years. What goes largely unreported is the fact that this will affect all of us in ways that we probably don't realize. People who don't have insurance still need to get health care, and in many cases they wait until it's too late, or they have an accident and wind up in the emergency room. That's very costly. Hospitals have to admit people. They had to at least stabilize them. So these people will still get care. It may not be optimal care, but hospitals in particular will wind up with a lot of so-called uncompensated care with people who are not able to pay their bills. They already are seeing big spikes in uncompensated care. People are in health plans with high deductibles, and they just simply don't have the money to pay out of pocket before their coverage will kick in. So they delay care, and often delay and delay and delay until they have a very serious illness or need to go to the hospital. And they still are not able to pay their medical bills. This will get even worse as more and more people are back into the ranks of the underinsured, obviously uninsured, and I suspect we'll see emergency rooms even more crowded than they are now. And we will see that a lot of small hospitals, particularly in rural areas, will be closing. They've already closed in many states. Many rural hospitals have closed because they see and treat a lot of people on Medicaid and Medicare, and they're not getting the compensation they need already. So this will be an additional hit for them. So we can expect to see a lot of hospital closures in the coming years. But I think that we will see that more and more people will decide that this is so broken, we've got to do something significantly different. And let's look to see what other countries have done that spend half as much as we do, ensure, make sure everybody is covered, and the quality of care is, in many cases, better, and people are living longer. I think it's the time is getting closer in which we're going to have another big debate, and I think the insurance industry is going to be standing largely alone.
That was Wendell Potter, president of the group's Center for Health and Democracy. Find more analysis and commentary on the links between the government shutdown and the nation's healthcare crisis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on KTWH in Two Harbors, Minnesota, KVRF in Palmer, Alaska, APS Radio nationwide, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.